Yes, I came across this quote of Nelson Mandela to the effect, if I can read it. Somebody who wrote this said she was seemingly quite moved when I mentioned a quote from Nelson Mandela, that quote, when we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give permission for others to do the same. Mm-hmm. So it's very well known, I think, for that kind of ethos.
Because I forgot, because the night we sang, the day before I found his inaugural speech, and someone gave that to me when I went to Millhaven Primary School, one of the teachers, stuck it in my pigeonhole, and I couldn't find out. I asked all the teachers, and they said, so no one told me who gave it, and I forgot it tonight, but I go, wow, that's just before we went back to sing, and it was just really, really eerie.
Oh, I thought it was a great project because I thought that connection between what happens in Australia and the wider Australian policy and the treatment of Indigenous people all of this time, and drawing that parallel between what happened in South Africa, was really important. And it was kind of news to me, actually, that there was that connection, an actual connection between the South African government and Australia. And, I mean, when you discover that, it's not surprising at all, really. So that was a really powerful thing for me, particularly, you know, our family history on my dad's side has been affected by the white Australia policy in one way or another, as they go back some generations in Australia. The other thing that was really, really strong for me was the power of song. And I felt really strongly that sort of connection to a whole range of songs that around the world that become important for people, and the way that those songs provide courage and comfort and sustenance and strength and all of those things. There's so many kind of in each situation. Some of them, I was, you know, interested to hear, so you sent me some material about Free Nelson Mandela, and that song was banned in South Africa, but somehow people got to play it in a football stadium as a kind of protest. And I thought that made that stadium thing reminded me of Allende and Chile, and those singers like Victor Jara and Vila Capara and so on. But you know, everywhere around the world, people singing these songs. So really, it's a powerful thing, some sort of elemental way that we can be together. You know, I still think that we can change things through song.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that even when you were speaking, Jane, about silence, I was thinking about Hard Times. There's that lyric. We changed the lyrics, actually. I can't think of it off the top of my head, but we sing... does anyone have Hard Times lyrics? Yes. Yeah, that's right. And we in the original lyrics it says, is it that their voices are silent?
Yeah.
And what was the people's, you know, when people say, oh, we've given someone a voice, it's like, no, it's that classic thing of like, no, people have got voices. It's that we choose not to listen or speak on top of or speak for or don't listen. So, you know, that was one of those kind of lines that I was thinking about when you were speaking, Jane, about like those voices are silenced, which is an active thing, and it's something that we have to take responsibility for, like whose voices are we silencing, who are we speaking on top of, and who, you know.
No Fixed Address was singing on Thursday night, singing We Have Survived,
and hard, you know, Hard Times is one of those songs, Bread and Roses is one of those songs, thinking about those songs that have legacies that continue to be important, the power of song. Yeah.
And more and more now, at the moment, with all the campaign around First Nations voice, who gives voice? Isn't our voice? You know, it's almost like people are asking to be heard, and people shouldn't have to ask to be heard. They should be very comfortable to be heard. Mm. So, there are lots of nuances in the
whole Absolutely. Thing.
A voice.
Mm.
Was it voices?
Mm. Like I've been speaking my voice loudly, and it's just that you haven't been listening this whole time. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear lots of people saying, yeah.
And the thing of song. I mean, we think of the civil rights movement in the United States, and the kind of how central singing those protest songs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in South Africa, protest songs and singing and what's called toy toy, where you kind of all march and move, kind of like a dance, but move together and sing. And everybody knew the songs.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knew some of the songs that were coded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't explicit, but everybody knew the meaning because you couldn't afford to sing them properly. So, you know, those songs were incredible. Kind of codes of cohesion, bringing it all together and sharing in solidarity. Yeah.
This reminds me, when a few of us have been in union choirs, but I was in the union choir in Brisbane, which is still an ongoing group. And I remember, actually, I just had my son, he's 31. But we had ANC, there was an ANC cultural worker in Australia, mm-hmm. Sipiwa Mbamba, I think his name was. And basically, there was a whole project, I think it went all around in Australia, teaching songs. So that repertoire was in the choir, and still is.
Because he's sick of it.
Yeah, because he's sick of it.
I was in the training choir in Adelaide. Yeah.
So when Desmond Tutu at one point came to Brisbane, we were asked by the council. There was a civic reception for him. And, I think they were certainly, just those experiences, very powerful in connecting us to the singing is made that more heartfelt.
And I had some Cape Town friends who came out here in the 60s and were very political and immediately made a connection with our Indigenous people and, you know, were really fascinated with Charlie Perkins and what he was doing going around in the 60s. And they were amazing. They really helped politicise me more because of their, you know, they were their lived experience of oppression and coming here. And they couldn't believe how, you know, apathetic we were, or just accepting of it, it seemed, you know. Even though, so, you know, I joined the trade union choir, and it was just, and the union movement was big, you know, I feel very much about that. You know, the May Day marches we used to have, we still do little things. But, so hopefully, you know, it will rise again.
Mm.
I agree with you that song is incredibly powerful, and to be here, and I'm fairly new to the area, but with 30 years of experience working, you know, in the territory with Aboriginal mob, and seeing constant social injustice for those 30 years, and the times where you think things maybe are changing, but they don't. And it's just the same cycle repeated over and over. You know, when I first got to the territory, I was in there in 1990, and I was travelling with these old Aboriginal people, and we stopped at Barrow Creek, and they were telling me, we should keep going. I'm going, no, we'll go and get a drink. Pulled up there, and all those old people were made to go to a hole in the wall outside. They weren't allowed in the front bar. So from that time on, I always went to that hole in the wall as well. So, you know, it's quite shocking. And I feel a little isolated from people in the territory because, you know, it's very close to a lot of people. So coming here, finding a new community who's got sort of same interests and same ideas and that solidarity through song has been incredible. So I thank you all.
Feelings mutual, Julianne.
Yeah, definitely. We can hear a bit more of your experience.
Oh, there's a lot of good stories.
Good stories, yeah.
And things haven't really changed. I mean, now that the voice is out there, you know, we're talking about, I'm talking to quite a few people about the voice, and I just get really depressed talking to them because they talk about something they've seen, and it's always negative rather than all the positive things that the First Nation people are doing. And, you know, you just feel like, you know, this morning I was talking to a group of four, and five, and three out of the five were arguing that about all these anecdotal things. And we, you know, said, you know, well, you know, what about the people you haven't seen? That's the thing with what's happening now. When we had the gender marriage, people knew someone that was gay, you know, in their own lives. I think that's the problem that we've got now, that they don't see Aboriginal people except for the ones that they're frightened of. They seem to be frightened. And this place, just sort of, it's good to come here and be able to sing a love singing with people, you know, and you feel that everyone's with you, you know, and so I just imagine how Aboriginals would feel if we ended up with a no vote, you know?
Yeah,
it's not that. Just
possibly.
We can't think about that now. We have to be positive. Yeah.
This is going back to this hall. A neighbour of mine was explaining she used to come here for regular Saturday night dances. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that, you know, when people weren't welcomed in pubs, this was certainly a place where people were very welcome as part of the union movement, and also specific events, not much.
They used to have the black and white dances here.
Were
they? Which I don't remember the exact. Well, I wasn't around then.
No,
I'm not. How old am I now? I don't remember the exact. Actually, I should have looked it up before tonight. But I remember as a kid being here in the hall. That Vitals used to do. And Ollie might know, but she's not here. But Vitals used to do like big dances, and I remember there were references. I used to. Work behind the bar. I don't know how old I was working behind the bar. I don't know about that. And we had, you know, big dances here, big nights, and but there was reference then as kind of like harking back to the black and white dances back then. And so that, I mean, that would have been in the 90s of those kind of reruns of the black and white dances. So there's definitely a strong history here. And so I was interested in I mean, I know a bit about this project, obviously, but what spurred this for you, for this particular... And it's a big question, isn't it? But if there's anything... You know what I mean? Like, it's your project. Like, is there anything that... is there anything that you'd like to share?
The parallels.
Mm.
Yeah, just hearing people... say when, because I'm involved in peace groups and things, and hearing people talking about the anti-apartheid era and how, you know, the work that they did, which is amazing. I lived in the bush at the time of the Springbok tour. I'd run away from Adelaide by then, but hearing people talk about it and then seeing right in front of them exactly the same thing, but on a lesser scale, because there's lesser people, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are a minority, whereas in South Africa that wasn't the case. But it just seemed wrong. And also, I wanted to sort of honour some of the work that was done, and so it was. The History Trust said yes. Gave me the money to do it, which surprised the hell out of me. I didn't ever think I'd get a grant, but we did. So,
well, thank you, Sue.
Yeah.
For me, I mean, I do remember well the occasion when we recorded the song, and I agree with what many people said, it was such a powerful occasion. For me also, there was a strong sense of joy, actually, on that night. Mm-hmm. And what it just brought back to me, in fact, was the time when the new South Africa came into being. Nelson Mandela became the president of the new nation. And it was in the early 90s, I think, 94, perhaps. I'm not quite sure.
First election in 94.
94, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, right. And there was a big celebration in Adelaide. It was at the Lion Arts Centre. Mm-hmm. And the South African community just all got together, and there were a lot of bands playing a lot of different kinds of music, and it was a powerful and joyous occasion. And when we sang that song, it just brought me back to that moment in time.
At the Lion Arts Factory.
Yeah, that's where it was. Yeah. Don't forget that night. Mm-hmm. It's really lit.
It took me back actually to when I was a kid growing up in France, and what you were saying, Sue, about, you know, the international exposure that apartheid got. And I think apartheid South Africa was my first experience. I was in school, it was my first kind of awareness, I guess, of racial segregation and the implications of it. And I just became acutely aware of, you know, like that sense of the human rights abuses, social injustice, etc. And it took so long, but it was always, you know, in the news on and off. And eventually, after so many years, I remember when Nelson Mandela was freed. I just remember thinking, wow, so it can happen. So if people just stand their ground, I was just awed. I was just like, oh my God, this man has just been in prison for so long, and he's got a whole section of the population still behind him because he stood his ground for what was right. And it was great singing that song. I just loved it. And it's funny because it also now really feeds, because I've become much more involved in climate activism. And that is what, you know, that was a very formative experience, I guess is what I'm trying to say, in terms of it feeds my hope and my determination, to just stand your ground, because when you know you're on the right side of history, you can't really do wrong. You just have this one direction that you need to go, and you're just going to do it. The other day we talked to some people about activism, and I actually used that example of, you know, I went to South Africa as my first experience of, you know, thinking about activism and where it can lead in a positive way.
And the danger of staying silent. I think the danger of staying silent and not speaking up. It's the worst thing in the world, you know, when we're able to shut up. And I think that's another good reason that we've got all of these people, 40-odd people, that come together for a choir and sing together. It's just fabulous.
Use our voices.
Okay?
Use our voices.
Yeah. Using our voices. Art's a good way to do that.
It does, yeah.
You know, message as well. And, you know, it made me, these discussions tonight also made me think of, you know, in Michael's family, they're from Estonia, and their independence, you know, in 91, the Baltic states had a singing revolution, and it was through song and singing that, you know, they became free of the Soviet. So it can happen. We can sing our songs to freedom.
In Estonia, they have a big song festival every 4 years now, and I think it might have been even more often in the past. And even back in the 1960s, the people at the Song Festival, and it would attract, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the one place at the one time. We're talking about the Estonian population is now 600,000, so we're talking about maybe a half a million. And they would begin to sing these songs that were banned by the Soviet Union. And we have 300,000 people, half the population, singing the banned song. You just can't stop it.
Mm.
You know, it's impossible for the authorities to stop that. And that was, so they were doing this for decades before they came to the singing revolution.
Yeah, thank you, Sue.
It was gorgeous. It was really, different. It wasn't just recreating what had happened.
And we've got to capture the village when we have to, because they're rare. We've got to capture them.